You are listening to 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. Stay tuned for the Heartland Labor Forum, radio that talks back to the boss. Welcome to the Heartland Labor Forum, a weekly show of news, information, and commentary by and for the working people of Kansas City. This show is produced by a team of volunteers from a broad range of workplaces and unions. The views expressed on the Heartland Labor Forum are ours and not necessarily those of KKFI or any unions involved. And welcome once again to the Heartland Labor Forum. We're glad you're here. Tonight's show is being underwritten by Blake and Ulig, PA, and United Steelworkers, District 11. Since 1972, Blake and Ulig has prided itself on providing comprehensive legal representation to labor organizations and their affiliated benefit funds on a local, regional, and national basis. And United Steelworkers, District 11, representing 35,000 members in the Midwest, protecting workers' rights, and organizing the unorganized. We support union-made products. The Heartland Labor Forum and KKFI thank our underwriters for their support. On tonight's show, Cuba is world famous for its healthcare system and for sending doctors to poor countries around the world. This week, or tonight, on the show, we'll talk to Missouri author and journalist Don Fitz about his new book on Cuban healthcare and how it's fighting COVID-19. Then, since eating is an essential activity, so are farm workers. But have we forgotten to protect them in the pandemic? We'll shine a light on the state of farm worker health care in Florida. In the news, so far no deaths for COVID-19 in Vietnam, thanks to the help from unions. And Kansas ACLU workers outraged by their employer's choice of a union-busting lawyer. Our feature at the end of the show is Remember Our Struggle with Arianna Eckel. And now for the news. The news from our side, July 9th, 2020. Next time you succumb to the urge to buy a bag of Fritos, think about the following. Katie Bernard of The Star reported last week that two former and one current Blank employees at Frito-Lay's Topeka plant filed suit alleging racial harassment and discrimination. They accused management of failing to discipline white employees who used racial slurs and threatened to lynch Black employees. They sued in U.S. District Court for Kansas. The suit also claims that Black employees were disciplined for offenses that white employees were not, that white employees were promoted ahead of Black employees, and that racist behavior in the plant was tolerated. The company said it couldn't comment on ongoing litigation, but said, of course, that Frito-Lay and its parent, PepsiCo, do not tolerate discrimination. However, employee Melvin Smith said he complained numerous times. He reported that a noose was found hanging in the plant and that a white employee had called a Black employee the N-word, but was never disciplined. On the other hand, Smith was suspended for 3 days after complaining to management for raising his voice and using offensive language. Management told Smith they felt threatened by him, though another manager in the meeting reported that Smith never raised his voice. Smith resigned in July 2018 because of threats and fears for his safety.
other countries are dealing with COVID-19 with a look at Cuba. But last week, Joe Buckley in Equal Times wrote about Vietnam and said, worker action has helped push the Vietnamese government to address COVID-19. At the time of the writing, there have been 334 cases and no deaths. Through strikes and workplace activity, workers have demanded protection and support. Vietnam took rapid steps after the first case of COVID appeared in January. It closed schools, provided good communication, began a rapid track and trace program, and quarantined all cases and contacts. Now, Vietnam is more or less back to normal, except for international flights, which are planned to reopen in July. An important part of this success, according to Buckley, was wildcat strikes, which began in February demanding PPE and other measures to prevent the virus in factories. Workers at the Domex garment factory, for example, went on strike, suspecting that a recently returned Chinese employee had coronavirus. In response, health authorities tested the Chinese national and put the person in quarantine for 14 days. At the end of March, two workers at Pine Tree Garment Factory fainted due to a lack of oxygen, triggering a strike in which workers demanded to be allowed to stay at home as a precaution against COVID-19. The factory owner refused, but many workers left anyway. In the end, management agreed to implement preventative measures such as providing masks and hand wash to create an airy environment and to pay salaries for any worker who needed to be quarantined. Contrast that to Honduras, also an authoritarian state, but which bows to the pressure from U.S. corporations to keep export sweatshop factories open. There this week, doctors threatened to go on strike if the government won't shut them down because they have become hotspots, generating most of the COVID cases. Honduras currently has 26,000 cases and almost 700 dead, while hospitals have collapsed and people wait outside for treatment under tarps.
When the 8 employees at the Kansas ACLU signed up with the United Media Guild, a CWA affiliate, and asked the union to send a letter to their boss, Executive Director Nadine Johnson, asking for voluntary recognition of their union, they were very hopeful that she'd immediately accept, but she didn't. She said no to recognition and to card check, which is a secret ballot election supervised by some community figure who both sides trust to determine if a majority of people in the bargaining unit want a union. Johnson told them to file instead with the Trump National Labor Relations Board in order to ensure a secret ballot election. What she didn't say at the time was that she would hire the firm of Ogletree Deacons to represent the ACLU. So who is Ogletree Deacons? They're the second largest union buster in the country. They have 53 offices in 31 U.S. states, Washington, D.C., the U.S. Virgin Islands, and in Canada, Mexico, and Europe. They've engaged in union busting since the 1970s when they represented J.P. Stevens, the textile firm where the real Norma Rae worked. They also represented corporate raider Frank Lorenzo when he destroyed Eastern Airlines and Nissan when the UAW tried to organize their plant in Tennessee. More recently, they've done their dirty work against the IAM at Boeing. They've represented Sheriff Joe Apeo in North Carolina. They helped to win a case for voter suppression. So far, their attorney, Tony Baergo, has challenged the bargaining unit, alleging that 3 of the 8 are in management, which would make the ACLU suspiciously top-heavy with managers. Tony also filed a motion saying that the ACLU is strictly Kansas organization, and therefore the workers have no right to organize. When Johnson started getting pushback on that very suspect assertion, she yanked his leash and made him withdraw that motion. Donors to the ACLU are asking whether Johnson is using their donations to pay Tony's fees, which are rumored to be $800 an hour. And many strong ACLU allies and supporters are asking why the organization would hire a firm that represents the antithesis of its values. Nadine Johnson responded to a request for a statement, said, "We want to ensure that the union represents a majority of the employees in an appropriate bargaining unit. Determining the bargaining unit involves a number of complex legal questions, and the organization could be liable for breaking the law if individuals are included who do not belong. We find out whether a union exists by secret ballot, and that hasn't happened yet," she added. "We're working on the representation concerns and looking forward to a positive and amicable process as we support our staff." Let's hope so, but what that process entails is a hearing at the NLRB where the challenged workers will be grilled about their jobs by Tony Baergo. One local union side labor attorney who knows Tony told us, "Tony Baergo is the nastiest, most dishonest POS management attorney I have dealt with in 31 years. Hands down, no contest." The union is demanding that the ACLU fire Ogletree Deacons and agreed to card check recognition of the union. The news was read by Judy Ansel, Chris Mann, and I'm Joyce McCauley.
The following statements are taken from the book Cuban Healthcare, written by Missourian Don Fitz.
"When I started my medical career," Cuban doctor Benitez said, "I thought if a child died of hunger, it was not my problem as a doctor. But now I understand that it is my problem."
Cuban doctor Diaz says, "We have a medical culture that promotes a warm, affectionate doctor-patient relationship, greeting patients by name with a kiss on the cheek, holding their hand and having them sit beside rather than across the desk from us."
Cuba has a record unmatched in dealing with chronic and infectious diseases with amazingly limited resources.
Cuba, which has the same life expectancy as the United States, spends only 4% per person of U.S. healthcare costs.
Cuba can evacuate entire cities during hurricanes, largely because medical teams know everybody in the neighborhood.
When New York City had 43,000 cases of AIDS, Cuba had only 200 cases.
Overcoming the HIV/AIDS crisis prepared Cuba for COVID-19.
The Cuban government immediately addressed a crucial shortage. It altered the equipment of nationalized factories, which made school uniforms, to manufacture medical masks.
Contact tracing would be used to determine who else might be exposed. Medical staff would need to go door to door to check on the health of every citizen.
The Cuban people would not tolerate the head of the country ignoring medical advice, spouting nonsensical statements, and determining policy based on what would be most profitable for the corporations.
Something must be done to save humanity. A better world is possible. Fidel Castro.
As you might guess from these introductory quotations, our topic tonight is healthcare in Cuba. Don Fitz is our guest, and he's on the editorial board of Green Social Thought. His book, Cuban Healthcare and the Ongoing Revolution, is available from Monthly Review Press. Don ran on the Green Party ticket for governor of Missouri in 2016. I'm Chris Mann, your host tonight, and we'd like to welcome Don. Let's get right to our questions. What was medical care like in Cuba prior to the revolution?
Okay, so what was happening in Cuba was that the medical care was not just inadequate, it was completely disjointed. There were all sorts of different ways to get medical care, either private pay-for-services, mutualism, which was sort of like an insurance company, or there was programs for low-income people. None of these were connected with each other. And the majority of people who had them were lived in the big cities like Havana or Santiago de Cuba. And then in the rural areas, a lot of times there were virtually nothing, and huge numbers of people had never seen a doctor. Also, there were zero systematic vaccination campaigns. There was no attempt to protect people from infection overall.
Now, I've read a little bit about the literacy campaign. Describe these mobilizations in Cuba and how that aided the medical system.
Well, the literacy campaign was by far the best known, and that was where students were recruited to go to the countryside and teach people to read and write, even if the person was 80 or 85 years old. And so a huge number of students went out to do that. And it was largely through the mobilizing efforts of people like Fidel who recruited people to do that. But there were also a lot of other campaigns, like such as sanitation. People would be taught how to keep things clean, how to not throw garbage in their yard, all sorts of other things that obviously dovetail with health care. There were campaigns against racism, challenging people to put aside the prejudices against slave descendants that had been in existence in Cuba ever since the days of slavery. And there's campaigns against sex discrimination, saying that women had the right to employment and the right to make personal decisions about their concerning their reproductive rights. And so all of these were going on at the same time. And so they were very critical in redesigning the medical system, especially the literacy campaign, because you really cannot teach people what sort of medications to take and what they need to do unless they can read the instructions, you know, take this medication like this, come to see the doctor at this time. And so literacy was very obvious, so was sanitation, but all the others, they were opening people up to say, okay, if you're black, if you're a woman, you have the right to these medical services, even if they've been denied to you in the past, you have the right now.
And I think your book mentioned too that for the first time, Cuba started putting hospitals where minorities were.
Yeah, hospitals and especially clinics too. There were lots of clinics in the Cuban system, but the rural areas were tremendously underserved. What they did is right after the revolution, they started to build clinics and they started to build them all over the island so that everybody would have access. But by 1964, they completely redesigned the clinics and they called them policlínicos integrales, and that translates to complete polyclinics or complete clinics. And what that meant was that they developed a whole range of services for people that were beyond just what a clinic might do. You would come to a single place to get everything, you know, all of the things that you needed, you would get at one location. And that was critically important for the revolution.
Can you define the polyclinic? I just want to tell our listeners here, it seemed from reading your book that Cuba has evolved and changed its medical system to fit the needs of the people. How did the polyclinic system develop?
Okay, well, there were big time periods in the revolution. For the first 5 years of the revolution, from 1959 to about 1964, the focus was on getting everybody getting children vaccinated, developing services for people who had not received them, and that extended throughout. But in 1964, the big change came about to have a single point of entry in the clinic. And so everybody, instead of going to one doctor for this and one doctor for that, everything would be centered at the clinic. And that was very critical in 1964. And so that lasted for more or less 10 years. And another critical time period was 1974, when people looked at the clinic system and saw it was felt that like it was incomplete. It was not completely integrated into the community. So they changed the name from Policlínico Integrales to Policlínico Comunitarios, and they were community clinics after 1974. And then in 1984, they felt they were still not sufficiently connected to the neighborhoods, and so you had doctor-nurse teams going out then. Now, I've mentioned the three time periods, 1964, 1974, and 1984. And those are just general road marks. In other words, things happen before each one of those years. Healthcare planners were thinking about things, and then in the particular year, the island didn't transform all of a sudden. You know, it took years to change the new method and spread it throughout the island. And so it was these were the years 64, 74, and 84, they were rough milestones, but they reflect like a 35-year continuous evolution of the medical system.
To begin with, Cubans took from the Soviet systems that were in place, but they didn't take it carte blanche. They didn't take the whole thing. And to me, what you just said about how the medical care system evolved is a credit to Cuba, because it shows, like in your title of the book, an ongoing revolution. There's ongoing positive changes. But what role did Fidel take in the healthcare system?
Okay, well, let me get back to the model of the of adopting from the Soviet Union. Cuba had a severe shortage of doctors right after the revolution. Close to half had left the country. They encouraged doctors from all over the world to come, and they were largely Soviet bloc doctors who came. And they looked at how the Soviet-type states set up their medical system. And what they found is that they all seem to be very top-down. One of the things which Cuba did, which was, they did a lot of things that were different, but probably the key thing that they did that was different, they did not make the clinics subservient to the hospital. The clinics and the hospitals were on an equal balance in each geographic area, and they both had a lot of autonomy in terms of how they applied rules. And so the clinics did not have to answer to the hospital. They were both had to answer to a higher level, you know, the province level or the state level. But keeping the clinics independent really made a tremendous difference in the evolution of the system. And then you were asking me about the role of Fidel. It's interesting because I've read a lot of Cuban books about things, about the medical system, as much as I can put my hands on. And if you look at what was written during this early time period, you know, during the first 35, 40 years of the when all the transformations occurred, you see over and over again people, you know, referring to the ideas, you know, brought by Comandante Fidel. And so I, in one of my visits, I asked doctors who had lived through the revolution. I mean, it seemed like that couldn't possibly happen, that Fidel Castro, who was not a physician, would think of each one of these changes. And so I asked them, I said, did Fidel actually think of these changes, or was he the person who is the mobilizer to make it happen? And all of them agreed with me. Fidel was not the person who redesigned the system, even though it might sound like that in the Cuban medical literature. What happened was that the medical experts in Cuba, you know, they had discussions, they had debates about where to go, and each one of these changes followed a lot of thinking and discussion. And when they agreed on the direction to go, then Fidel picked up on that, and he was the national spokesperson. And he mobilized people throughout the island to say, okay, well, we're going to have a big change in medical organization, so be prepared for it. This is going to be great. You need to work with us to make it happen. So Fidel, the great speechmaker, was the great motivator for helping these medical changes happen.
Yeah, and now can you explain the role of the committees for the defense of the revolution? They were also deeply involved with the healthcare, and how was that?
Okay, well, the CDRs, Committees for the Defense of the Revolution, evolved somewhere like, started, I think it was 1960, could have been 1961. But when the United States was first threatening Cuba, especially the Bay of Pigs invasion and the missile crisis, which happened in the early 1960s, Cuba wanted to defend itself, and it realized there may have to be block-by-block defense. So on each block or group of two or three blocks, there would be a Committee for Defense of the Revolution. And that's where the guns were stored, you know, and that's where people would go if there was an invasion of Cuba. And people were prepared for it, and they were ready for it, and they were ready to defend the revolution. Well, by the time the late 60s come around, it's pretty clear there's not going to be an invasion of Cuba from the United States. And so what happened was the CDRs became more and more involved in medicine. From the very first days, the CDRs were involved in evacuating people. Now, in Cuba, you periodically have hurricanes. And it's amazing if you look at the death rate of hurricanes in the United States and the death rate from hurricanes in Cuba, it's very, very low in Cuba. Because what happens as soon as they know that a hurricane is going to happen, then the CDR goes into action, and they have to be able to evacuate everybody, and that includes people who are disoriented, who are mentally ill, who are physically, you know, people who are in a wheelchair, people who have dementia and can't figure out what's going on. So every CDR has to have a plan of how to evacuate every single person in that one, two, or three block area, and that's what they all do. And also the CDRs, as time went on, they started to be involved in more and more health campaigns, like combating flies and mosquitoes, and telling people how to do sanitation, you know, so that they don't throw out their garbage, and controlling infectious diseases, donating blood. And one of the big things that people don't think of as a health repair, if, unless you've been to Cuba, is repairing streets. Now, if you have ever been to Cuba, you know that some of the side streets have potholes that are absolutely enormous. And so the CDRs, you know, will try to recruit people to help fill in those potholes, because, of course, if your car is damaged, that may be your most expensive possession in Cuba. And you don't want people to have broken bones or have other injuries from potholes. So everything which is connected to healthcare that needs a mobilization of people to work for it, the CDR is somehow connected with that today.
So in a central theme, we have 3 minutes left, Don. This time's going so fast.
Okay.
A central theme of the medical system in Cuba is that the structure of the medical system is not separate and distinct from social relationships fostered by that structure. What do you mean?
Okay. In the United States, the structure of social relationships is that you go to a doctor after you have symptoms, and you have the social relationships if it's a person to a business. And now there are fewer and fewer people go to a doctor just to go to the office. It's usually a business. In Cuba, it's not like that at all. Your first round of going to a physician will be at the doctor-nurse clinic, which is in your neighborhood. And the doctor and the nurse live in that neighborhood, say they know everyone. So the medical relationship is a personal relationship in Cuba in a way that it's virtually never existed in the United States.
One more critique in your book, you have the effectiveness of the Cuban healthcare system is largely due to the interconnectedness of its components, totally unlike the U.S. healthcare system.
Explain. Okay, that's really a critical component that came out in COVID-19. And what they did in COVID-19 was very similar to what Cuba has done with to combat dengue fever and other epidemics that have happened in Cuba. You have medical students who then go to the family doctor office, and they work with them to go to everybody in the neighborhood. So they're completely connected with that. The neighborhood doctor nurse office is completely connected to the clinic, because the clinic coordinates the works of the neighborhood doctor's offices. And in addition, the clinic is completely connected to the hospital. And whenever somebody goes into a hospital, they usually gone from the doctor's office to the clinic, then to the hospital. It might be from the doctor's office directly to the hospital. The physician always follows the patient to the hospital and knows exactly what's going on. The students who are working there, when they provide data for the doctor's office, that data also goes to all of the research institutes. And so the medical students are connected with that. And lastly, the specialty hospitals, which would include things like nursing homes and places to research specific diseases like kidney diseases, they are also connected to the medical schools. And so a neighborhood physician who says, okay, well, this person needs to go to a nursing home, that physician will follow the person to the nursing home. And so there's no such thing in Cuba as all of these different parts of a medical system being disconnected from each other and people not knowing the charts, not having the information, and no personal connection. In Cuba, it's a connection, and it's not just a connection of how the different places are set up. It's a connection with the person's family doctor and family nurse, knowing everything about the person wherever the person needs to go.
And we're about out of time, Don. We got about 30 seconds. Can you describe what Cuba has done with COVID-19 so far?
Okay, that's basically what Cuba did with COVID-19. First of all, the first national plan was on March 2nd, before anybody died. And by March the 22nd, when the first person died in Cuba, they already had the plan well into effect. It was already in place. And they already had systems designed for doctors who would go to hospitals and would work in a hospital for only 14 days and then go into isolation. And the person would stay at the hospital overnight. The doctor would then stay overnight, not working with patients, but 14 days in a separate area of the hospital. And then the person would, I'm sorry, it's 15 days. And then the person would go back home and be in quarantine for 15 days before ever going back to the hospital again. And so people were, the physicians and all healthcare practitioners were effectively isolated so that they would minimize the chance of COVID-19 spreading. And that's why Cuba has a COVID-19 rate vastly below the United States today. It's because they were prepared with an integrated healthcare system.
Well, we've got to leave it there. Don, where can people find your book?
Very easily. Just remember the title of it, Cuban Healthcare, The Ongoing Revolution.
Let's explore, let's question, let's decolonize together on Ebony's Bones.
Tune in every Wednesday from 6 p.m. to 7 p.m. on 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio.
I am Angela Believes. July 9th, 7 p.m. on Thursday night special, Stand Up, we will be talking with Ms. Gwendolyn Grant, President and CEO of the Urban League of Greater Kansas City, about racism and racial violence. It is our hope you will tune in and join the conversation. Thursday night special, July 9th at 7 p.m.
Hello, this is Joyce McCauley, and we are welcoming Celia Perez, a farm workers leader, and Jordan Lakes, her translator. They are from the Fair Food Alliance, which is part of the Coalition of the Immokalee Workers. Thank you for taking your time to speak with us about the lives of migrant workers. The term essential workers has become a household term, of course, during the time of this pandemic. However, it seems that the migrant workers who are responsible for getting food in the grocery stores and on our table have been silent or outright ignored. So thank you for the work you do to support these workers. The first thing I'd like us to do is what is the Fair Food Alliance? Tell us about that.
Okay. Tendría que es la Alianza por Comida Justa y también la, entonces, ya, la coalición también.
Okay. La coalición es un grupo de trabajadores que fue formado en los años 92 para arriba para eliminar los abusos que por años existían con los trabajadores en los campos.
Mm-hmm. So the coalition, and we're going to answer this as the coalition first because that's the central group that unites our organizations. The Coalition of Immokalee Workers is a group of farm workers that has been organizing from the early 90s and on to protect the human rights of farm workers.
Y ese grupo fue organizado con trabajadores del campo que son de México y de Guatemala y de Haití, y fueron ellos que se empezaron a organizar para ver qué es lo que se podía hacer con los trabajadores porque había muchos robos de salarios, había mucho acoso sexual, violencia con los trabajadores, abuso verbal, y todo eso existía con los trabajadores.
Mm-hmm. And the coalition was founded by a group of workers that were working in the fields from Mexico, Guatemala, and Haiti. These workers were organizing against abuses that they themselves were facing, and these abuses included wage theft, sexual violence, sexual harassment, and in extreme cases, forced labor conditions.
Y yo creo que su otra pregunta, lo que dijo, ¿qué es la Alianza? La Alianza es un grupo aparte que son estudiantes que también trabajan también con la red de estudiantes al nivel nacional para apoyar a los trabajadores del campo.
Yes, so to answer the other part of your question, the Alliance for Fair Food is a group of students, and I would also add other consumer allies, who are part of the Fair Food Movement, who organize in solidarity with the Coalition of Immokalee Workers to push forward their campaigns.
Okay, it sounds like a great organization. We know that there's a lot of negative things going on in Florida in regards to the treatment of the migrant workers, and DeSantis, the governor, has not treated them kindly or just respectfully by making sure they are they have masks or other PPE information or items. So can you tell our listeners what is happening in Florida with the workers and the other migrant workers?
Mm-hmm. Entonces, hemos oído muchas cosas negativas sobre lo que está pasando hacia los trabajadores en los campos en la Florida. También hemos escuchado la manera que el gobernador Ron DeSantis no ha respondido a esas cosas con acción. Los trabajadores todavía son sin protección para sí mismos y también no tienen protección desde él. Entonces, ¿qué son las condiciones ahorita para los trabajadores en los campos?
Las condiciones de los trabajadores ahorita es muy difícil para que los trabajadores tienen como acceso a cuidado médico, porque un trabajador del campo no tiene aseguranza, no tienen nada de eso, y los trabajadores del campo se mueven. La temporada en Florida se acabó en mayo, entonces los trabajadores están emigrándose a otros estados, a Georgia, Sur Carolina, Norte Carolina, Nueva Jersey, Maryland, Virginia, Nueva Jersey. Se fueron a seguir la temporada allá los trabajadores.
Mm-hmm. So right now, this is a very difficult time for workers. Many workers that are laboring in the field do not have any sort of medical care. Lots of them work without insurance. And as well, these workers are moving. They're working to follow the harvest. So the tomato harvest, for example, here in Immokalee, ended in May, and many people have traveled up the coast. They've gone to New Jersey, New York, Virginia, and other states north of Florida to follow the harvest, which creates unsafe conditions as well.
As they follow the harvest, is there anyone along the way that checks in with them medically to find out if one of the workers has contacted COVID or if they need treatment of any kind? Is there any medical treatment along the way or when they get to the next farm?
Mm-hmm. Cuando siguen la cosecha, los trabajadores agrícolas, hay alguien que está checando si su salud, si tienen COVID, si estaban en contacto con alguien con COVID. Hay algunas protecciones cuando lleguen a otro rancho.
Hay rancheros que están participando junto con el programa Con Comida Justa y la coalición. Esos rancheros que están participando, los trabajadores también son vigilados por los rancheros, porque y ellos se encargan de llevar, hacer los exámenes o vigilar que ningún trabajador puede estar como sin cuidado médico, sin cuidado de salud en su área de trabajo. Y también la coalición siempre están como se ha estado mandando mascarillas, desinfectante para los trabajadores, que el condado también nos ayudó a conseguirlos. Entonces la coalición los mandó todo esas mascarillas para los trabajadores, para que la compañía los reparte a los trabajadores en su lugar de trabajo.
Yeah, so no, this is not happening outside of the Fair Food Program. However, farms that are participating in the Fair Food Program, which I would add is the program that the Coalition of Immokalee Workers wrote to protect workers' rights, are taking some steps to protect their workers, such as taking them to get tests before or after work, or instead of a day of work, taking their workers to go get tested. This helps people who, again, do not have any sort of medical protections or insurance. And another thing that the Coalition of Immokalee Workers has been doing here in town and has been working in partnership with some farms that participate in the Fair Food Program is handing out masks to give to workers who are working in the fields. And this has been done both on behalf of the farms who are employing workers and by the coalition themselves.
Okay.
¿Puedo agregar algo?
Can I add something?
Yes.
Sí. Oh, okay. Y lamentablemente los que enfrenten más este virus que está pasando es los trabajadores por los bajos recursos, por la pobreza, y ellos son los que están enfrentando más este virus que estamos pasando, la gente de color, la gente trabajadora del campo. La gente trabajadora del campo son trabajadores esenciales, y nuestro gobernador de Florida, él dijo que los trabajadores tienen la culpa, los trabajadores son reemplazados, pero él está hablando al revés. No son así, los trabajadores son importantes en este país para llevar la comida en nuestras mesas, para mantenerlo en nuestras familias y para mantener también en este país.
Mm-hmm. So, unfortunately, the people who are facing this pandemic the most and who are most at risk are farm workers. And this is because of low wages that they receive that force them into specific living conditions, crowded conditions. It's because there's not so much the option to work, it's a necessity to work. During this time, as farm workers have been deemed essential workers, there's not an option to go to work or not. As well, many workers need to go to work every day to make sure that they can feed their families. People don't have the privilege of taking days off from work. And this has affected mostly the working community, people of color, but workers in the field are facing this the most. And our governor, Ron DeSantis, has gone so far as to blame these workers in the field that he says are replaceable for the spread of COVID in our area and for the increasing cases.
Yes, and I also read that he even said something about they shouldn't be around the general population, just not really intelligent kind of stuff.
Que esas personas no deben estar con la gente normal.
Could you explain a little more, or elaborate a little bit more about the conditions, the living conditions, and their travel, how the travel takes place?
Mm-hmm. ¿Puedes decir más sobre las viviendas y también cómo se viajen las personas hacia el norte?
Las viviendas aquí en nuestra comunidad de Imócale, las viviendas viven los trabajadores en trailers móviles, y los trabajadores llegan a vivir de 10 o a 12 personas en una vivienda, porque el precio de las viviendas son muy caras, y entonces el trabajador tiene que vivir amontonado porque no hay otra opción. El trabajador no puede pagar una vivienda solito porque son 300 o 350 por semana que le cobren aquí para una vivienda.
Mm-hmm. So workers here, many workers that live in mobile homes, and these mobile homes are usually filled with anywhere between 10 and 12 people. And the reason that workers need to live in such crowded living conditions is because the cost of living, even in these trailer homes, is so expensive. One does not have the privilege of being able to live in a mobile home by themselves, because people can't afford that. The cost of living in a mobile home here is between $300 and $350 per week.
And of course, they don't make that much, so they have to share the expenses in order to make sure that they have food as well as a place to live.
Mm-hmm. Y también no están ganando eso, entonces necesitan buscar otras personas para vivir. Y también Silvia, la pregunta del viaje.
Ya, eso es lo que le iba a decir. Los trabajadores, cuando se acaba la temporada aquí, viajan con las... Si ellos trabajan con las compañías aquí en Imócale, trabajan con las compañías que son participantes con el programa, la compañía se encarga de llevar los trabajadores en un autobús para los diferentes estados a seguir la temporada, donde hay temporada para cosechar.
Mm-hmm. So with farms that are under the Fair Food Program, these farms actually take workers in a bus up north to look for work in other harvests.
So they don't automatically have that work in place. When they leave one harvest section, one farm, and go to another, they could be told, no, we're fine, we have enough people, you have to go to the next farm. Is that correct?
Mm-hmm. Entonces, no es seguro que ellos tienen trabajo cuando salen del pueblo. ¿Es correcto?
Los trabajadores sí tienen trabajo porque son las mismas compañías que cultivan aquí en la Florida y son las mismas compañías que producen tomate en otros estados. Por eso ellos se encargan de llevar de los trabajadores a cada estado donde los rancheros producen sus productos.
So many workers do leave here with security in their work in other states because it's mostly the same companies. These are very large companies. So when they're being left, and that's especially why it's beneficial for these companies to bring workers up north, is it secures their workforce as well.
Okay. And then I know we've kind of talked already that the virus has spread within the farm community. Is it pretty extensive? Are there numbers? Do we know what percentage of farm workers have come down with the virus?
Sabemos que está pasando muy rápido en el pueblo de Mockley el COVID, pero ustedes tienen números o un porcentaje de los que están saliendo positivo con COVID.
Sí, cada día el condado da un resumen y entonces nosotros también recibimos ese resumen de contagiado todos los días. El día de hoy yo creo que ya eran como 1,600 casos contagiados. Cada día sube a 20 o 30 personas contagiadas en un solo día aquí en nuestra comunidad.
So yes, the numbers are published every day by the Department of Health. We check these numbers every day. Right now, and I'm checking on this right now, the number as of yesterday of positive cases in Mockley was 1,657. And we are seeing that every single day the number rises at least about 20 to 30 people. And I would also add that the positivity rate that people we're seeing right now in Immokalee is 35% of people who are getting tested are testing positive.
Okay. Are a lot of these people asymptomatic?
Muchos de las personas que están saliendo positivo tienen síntomas o no?
Yo creo que algunos que sí y otros casi la mayoría sí. Padecieron síntomas y otros apenas se están enfermando. Y como ese virus es bien contagioso, si se enferma uno en la casa, se tiene que enfermar todo. Entonces, pero hay unos que sí, otros que son contados los que no desarrollan síntomas, pero la mayoría, todos se enfermaron, las personas que nosotros llegamos a escuchar aquí en nuestra comunidad.
So the majority are experiencing symptoms. Many people also go to get tested that are just barely starting to become sick with COVID, but it is pretty much assured that if you are living with someone that has COVID, whether they're experiencing or not, you are also going to contract COVID. But we are, lots of people in our community, people that we are communicating with all the time, have been experiencing symptoms of COVID-19 when they test positive.
Okay. We've only had a couple of minutes left, so I would really like it if you could tell us what people can do to support you and how listeners can contact you if they want to help.
Solo tenemos unos minutos más, pero nos cuentan cómo apoyarán la gente que está escuchando y cómo nos contactan si necesitan ayuda o tienen preguntas.
Sí, yo creo que estamos agradecidos, ¿verdad?, de recibir muchos apoyos de muchas radios, de muchos como entrevistas que hemos hecho, y estamos pues nosotros felices que ellos están escuchando la realidad, cómo es la vida de un trabajador que trabaja en los campos. Sabemos que los trabajadores en los campos es la vida que se tiene que vivir para trabajar, para mantener a sus familias, para ganarse el pan de cada día todos los días. Pero estamos muy felices que recibimos apoyo al nivel nacional, la gente de las iglesias, los estudiantes, nos han donado muchas mascarillas, mucho el desinfectante casi no estuvo como mucho, y las mascarillas, algunas organizaciones, algunas personas que nos donaron muchas mascarillas para repartir a los trabajadores aquí en la comunidad.
Mm-hmm. So thank you so much for this question, and thanks so much to so many people who have been supporting our work. We have been so happy to be doing radio interviews, to be on the news, to be talking about the reality that people are experiencing here in Immokalee. What is it really like to be an essential worker during this time, a farm worker during this time, which is really difficult, and it takes a lot to put food on the table right now and to take care of one's kids. And so we're so grateful for students, for people of faith, and for everybody who has been supporting what we've been doing during this time to protect this community. Things that have been done to support our work, we've received many donations of masks, which have been going out into the community every week. People have sent us sanitizer.
That sounds really great. We've really run out of time. In fact, we're a minute over. So if people, can I just tell people to go to the website and contribute, and that can help out a lot?
Yes.
Okay, very good.
DAW-online.org.
Okay, thank you both so much, and we'll keep, we'll kind of keep tabs on you through a website and stuff and try and really be aware of what the workers need.
Good evening and welcome to Remember Our Struggle. I'm Ariana Eckel, journeyman wireman of IBEW Local 124. I've been hearing from so many people recently that they feel a sense of hope in the air, of possibility, of change. Tonight, I'm rebroadcasting a show from 2018 about another time of possibility, questioning, and experimentation. Way back in 1936, across the Atlantic Ocean in Spain, workers had an opportunity to engage in a massive social experiment that questioned and challenged the very way we view work and the organization of the economy and even society itself. The Spanish Civil War took place from 1936 to 1939. Interestingly, the combatants were organized not by geographical area, but by political ideology. The war had multiple sides. The Republicans, who were loyal to the left-leaning and relatively urban Second Spanish Republic, fought against the Nationalists, a Falangist, Carlist, Catholic, and largely aristocratic group led by General Francisco Franco. People within Republican Spain rose up and deposed their lords and bosses. Farm-working peasants seized the farms they worked on and collectivized them. Workers in industries as wide as manufacturing to food service collectivized, and for the first time, workers themselves began to manage their own work and production. We're talking about a very large number of people here. Estimates of the numbers of people in collectives range as high as 5 to 7 million directly or indirectly involved. In the city of Aragon, an estimated 69.5% of the 430,000 inhabitants in the Revolutionary Zone took part in collectives in total. So when we say collective, what exactly are we talking about here? For an example, around 3,000 enterprises in the city of Barcelona were collectivized. In these workplaces, an assembly of all workers elected a special council to run each workplace. Every section of the workplace elected delegates to liaise with the council on day-to-day matters. The council sent easily recallable representatives to a greater council for each industry, which drew up general plans for that whole industry. Equal wages were paid to everyone, wages which were higher than the average wage most of the workers had been receiving prior to collectivization. They got to split the profits of their labor rather than it siphoned off by the boss. In this way, it must be noted, there are no bosses. Those who hold managerial responsibilities are themselves the elected representatives of the workers themselves. Therefore, management is not only responsible for the success of the business, but also the working conditions and wages of its workers. This revolution in the way that workers looked at work also occurred in the Spanish countryside. After the major landowners had been chased off the land, the workers called an assembly. They decided that they would seize all land and machinery and hold it in common between all people. Teams were formed to tackle various jobs, and each elected its own recallable delegates to a village assembly. To distribute the common stock of goods during wartime, rationing in the form of a family wage was created. Although the ideal they pursued included the free distribution of food and other basic necessities, this was not practical during the war effort. However, there was a major increase in living standards for most people, and everyone had a greater say. For example, we can look at the village of Graus. There, the family wage meant a 15% increase in money going into households. All services such as electricity and gas were made free. The healthcare system was dramatically improved and also made free. Even education and entertainment capacities were greatly improved. Overall, this translated to an increase in living standards of 50 to 100%. This new means of organizing production also led to many increases in productivity and efficiency. In Esplus, there were 4 new piggeries producing hundreds of animals, and the sheep herd increased from 600 to 2,000. In Mas de las Mantas, a huge collective bakery handled all the baking, previously the exclusive task of women in the home. In Alcoriza, there had been a 50% increase in cultivated land and centralization of tailor shops, which brought a 66% increase in production. In most cases, productivity under collectivization was much more efficient than it had been under the landlord system, and had the added benefit of ending the starvation many peasants and other poor working people had previously faced each year due to production planned on profit for a few, rather than community sustainability for all. Alas, these very promising experiments were largely ended with the taking of Spain by the fascist forces of Mussolini. Today, though, Spain is again a beacon of collective experimentation. Hope you enjoyed the show tonight. Have a great evening.
Hi, this is Judy Ansel. And instead of the Heartland Labor Forum calendar, which you can find on our Facebook page at on Facebook, Heartland Labor Forum, just look it up. I want to tell you some breaking news. We just received notice from Nadine Johnson, the executive director of the Kansas ACLU, that she has fired Ogletree Deacons, the union-busting firm that was on the news tonight. And that's it for our show. Our show tonight, tune in next week to our show. It's going to be called SEIU Healthcare. We're going to have people from the union, which represents the workers at Truman Medical Center, as well as at Menorah and Research Hospitals, to talk about essential workers and are essential workers entitled to labor rights. And then we're going to be talking about the Missouri Medicaid expansion initiative that is on the August 2nd ballot. Thanks to tonight's engineer, Keith Washburn. Stay tuned to the Thursday night special. Listening to the Heartland Labor Forum, a show by and about workers, our workplaces, and our labor movement. We are radio that talks back to the boss, and you can talk back too. Send us your workplace stories, news, and ideas for shows to heartlandlaborforumkkfi@gmail.com. Our website, where we archive shows and post our upcoming schedule, is heartlandlaborforum.org. The views expressed on the Heartland Labor Forum are ours and not necessarily those of KKFI or any of the unions involved. Tune in every Thursday evening to the Heartland Labor Forum at 6 o'clock or to our Friday morning rebroadcast at 5 o'clock right here at 90.1 FM KKFI.
The guy.